Part 1.
You will hear a conversation between Harry and Andrea, two students who have just finished their final exams. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. Listen carefully to the conversation and answer questions 1 to 5.
Hi, Andrea. How are you feeling now that exams are over?
It's fantastic to have finished, isn't it? And to sleep in every morning. What about you?
Well, I've been catching up on sleep too, but I've got a lot to do before I leave for England. Perhaps you could give me some advice. I've got a lot of things I can't possibly take back with me, but I don't know what to do with them.
Well, it depends on what sort of things they are and whether you're thinking of giving them away or selling them.
Well, almost everything. Furniture, the fridge and other kitchen stuff that I bought from the previous tenant. But the new people have already got what they need, so they're not interested in buying stuff from me. I can't afford to give it away, but I'm not sure how to sell it all. Oh, and there are some clothes and books as well.
Why can't you take them?
The books are really heavy. It's so expensive if you exceed the airline baggage allowance. And the clothes just won't all fit in my suitcase. It's amazing how much stuff I've accumulated since I've been here. Anyway, I don't think I'll need as many summer clothes in England as I have here in Australia.
I see. Well, there are several alternatives. First of all, you could put up notices around the university about the books. You know, on the notice boards in the Student Union building and in the Economics Department. Anywhere second and third year students will see them. People are always keen to buy cheap textbooks.
Okay, what should I say on the notices?
Just put the titles, authors, and price you want, your name of course, and maybe put your phone number on those little tear-off tags.
That's a good idea. And what about the furniture?
You could try doing the same thing, but usually students are away all summer, so they don't want to buy furniture now. Another place to try might be a second-hand shop. Someone from the shop will usually come around and give you a free quote, and then you can decide. But you don't usually get much money for that sort of stuff.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10.
Another alternative is to put an advertisement in the Trading Post. Do you know that paper? It comes out every week advertising things people want to sell. You have to pay to put the advert in and then hope people phone. Give them as much information as possible, and if they're interested, invite them to come and have a look. The hard part is agreeing on a price.
No, I haven't seen the Trading Post. But I should have a look at it, and I could advertise the fridge, the microwave, and the furniture. But the kitchen stuff isn't really that good. You know, old cutlery, a few pots and pans, and some plates and things. What shall I do with them?
Well, another option is to donate the kitchen things to a charity shop. You know, like the Salvation Army or St. Vincent de Paul. Why don't you get a second-hand shop to give you a quote first?
Yes, I could do that. Find out how much they'll give me and then decide whether to sell them or give them away. But I've still got the clothes.
A charity shop will take them too, as long as they're in good condition. And even though you don't get any money, at least you know that someone who really deserves some help has benefited.
That's a good point. I'll advertise the expensive stuff, the furniture, and donate the clothes and kitchen stuff. Let's go and buy a trading post and you can help me write the advert.
Well, actually, I'm interested in buying the fridge and the microwave, depending on the price, of course.
Okay, let's see how good you are at bargaining.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear an extract from a talk about facilities for students with disabilities. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 13. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 13.
Welcome to Student Times, the programme with all the latest on what's happening at universities around the country. Today we'll be discussing disabled applicants and the kind of support they can expect to find, or not find, at the university of their choice. With me to tell us more is Student Disability Advisor Sally Taylor. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Hugh. I'd like to start by pointing out that although one in four people has some kind of disability, the proportion among students is much lower. This is partly because most students are under 25 and many people only develop their disabilities as they get older, but it's also because some universities don't do much to encourage access. It is true, though, that some have quite sticky problems when it comes to, for instance, wheelchair access, ancient buildings, cobbled streets built centuries ago, and so on. When faced with such a situation, some universities make an extra special effort to provide for students with particular disabilities, while others have specialist accommodation. In fact, all universities should have a written policy statement on students with disabilities, setting out what facilities they have, what their attitude is, and what they're prepared to do. But having said that, only you can properly understand the challenges of any disability you have, and so before accepting a place at a university, or even while you're considering applying, if only to raise the university's awareness, it's good to talk to them and find out how much they can and will do for you. The problem is who to talk to. Most universities and some students' unions have a disability advisor who is supposed to know what facilities they already have and will help with further arrangements if necessary or possible. However, all too often this person is a token. Sometimes it's just an extra responsibility given to a secretary. They don't know what the situation is in practice, and they don't have any real authority to change anything. So, given that for any prospective student, it's best to visit a university before applying, it's an especially good idea for students with disabilities or special needs to check whether the place really does come up to scratch. In general, the university should provide personal care and assistance, and there are certain key features to look out for if you have a particular disability, including the following.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 14 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 14 to 20.
Firstly, if your mobility is impaired, check there are ramps and easy access to all buildings, not just accommodation or teaching rooms. Then, when you're inside, look for clear instructions on fire and emergency procedures for the disabled. Also, make sure there are lifts that work, not the usual ones that seem to be out of order half the time. And check for suitable lavatory facilities. There is a different set of things to look for if you suffer from any kind of hearing impairment. There should be induction loops in lecture theatres, flashing sirens in all rooms, and in accommodation, visual doorbells that light up when somebody calls round to see you. If it is your sight that is impaired, there obviously need to be braille translators of books and documents. In all buildings, the stairs, floors, doorways, and windows must have clear markings, and there also have to be special fire and emergency procedures for you. If you suffer from dyslexia, you will need a computer for general use and in exams. And as exams may take you longer to complete, you should be allowed extra time in which to do so. This applies to work in general too. There are, of course, many other possible health difficulties that you may suffer from, such as diabetes, epilepsy, or heart conditions. If this is the case, check the availability of access to appropriate treatment, including medication and/or therapy. Finally, make sure that in the event of an emergency, it is clear what you and other people who may be involved have to do.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part three.
Part three. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 26. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 26.
Good evening, and welcome to this month's Observatory Club lecture. I'm Donald Mackey, and I'm here to talk to you about the solar eclipse in history. 1,000 years ago, a total eclipse of the sun was a terrifying religious experience. But these days, an eclipse is more likely to be viewed as a tourist attraction than as a scientific or spiritual event. People will travel literally miles to be in the right place at the right time to get the best view of their eclipse. Well, what exactly causes a solar eclipse? When the world goes dark for a few minutes in the middle of the day. Scientifically speaking, the dark spot itself is easy to explain. It is the shadow of the moon streaking across the Earth. This happens every year or two, each time along a different and, to all intents and purposes, a seemingly random piece of the globe. In the past, people often interpreted an eclipse as a danger signal heralding disaster, and in fact, the Chinese were so disturbed by these events that they included among their gods one whose job was to prevent eclipses. But whether or not you are superstitious or take a purely scientific view, our earthly eclipses are special in three ways. Firstly, there can be no doubt that they are very beautiful. It's as if a deep blue curtain had fallen over the daytime sky as the sun becomes a black void surrounded by the glow of its outer atmosphere. But beyond this, total eclipses possess a second, more compelling beauty in the eyes of us scientists, for they offer a unique opportunity for research. Only during an eclipse can we study the corona and other dim things that are normally lost in the sun's glare. And thirdly, they are rare. Even though an eclipse of the sun occurs somewhere on Earth every year or two, if you sit in your garden and wait, it will take 375 years on average for one to come to you. If the moon were any larger, eclipses would become a monthly bore. If it were smaller, they simply would not be possible. The ancient Babylonian priests, who spent a fair bit of time staring at the sky, had already noted that there was an 18-year pattern in their recurrence, but they didn't have the mathematics to predict an eclipse accurately.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 27 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 27 to 30.
It was Edmund Halley, the English astronomer, who knew his maths well enough to predict the return of the comet, which incidentally bears his name, and in 1715 he became the first person to make an accurate eclipse prediction. This brought eclipses firmly into the scientific domain, and they have since allowed a number of important scientific discoveries to be made. For instance, in the eclipse of 1868, two scientists, Janssen and Lockyer, were observing the sun's atmosphere, and it was these observations that ultimately led to the discovery of a new element. They named the element helium after the Greek god of the sun. This was a major find, because helium turned out to be the most common element in the universe after hydrogen. Another great triumph involved mercury. I'll just put that up on the board for you now. See, there's Mercury, the planet closest to the sun, then there's Venus, Earth, etc. For centuries, scientists had been unable to understand why Mercury appeared to rotate faster than it should. Some astronomers suggested that there might be an undiscovered planet causing this unusual orbit, and even gave it the name Vulcan. During the eclipse of 1878, an American astronomer, James Watson, thought he had spotted this so-called lost planet. But alas for him, he was later obliged to admit that he had been wrong about Vulcan and withdrew his claim. Then Albert Einstein came on the scene. Einstein suggested that rather than being wrong about the number of planets, astronomers were actually wrong about gravity. Einstein's theory of relativity, for which he is so famous, disagreed with Newton's law of gravity in just the right way to explain Mercury's odd orbit. He also realized that a definitive test would be possible during the total eclipse of 1919, and this is indeed when his theory was finally proved correct. So there you have several examples of how eclipses have helped to increase our understanding of the universe. And now let's move on to the social.
That is the end of part 3.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part 4.
Part 4.
You will hear an extract from a talk about student health, and specifically about ways to avoid headaches. Listen to what the speaker says and complete the summary. First, look at questions 30 to 40. As you listen to the talk, answer questions 30 to 40. Complete the summary.
Hello. Welcome to the Student Orientation Program. Today's session is on health issues, and this talk is about headaches and how to avoid them. It may surprise you to hear that headaches are often caused by hunger. In fact, one study suggested that 70% of headaches are related to hunger, which makes it the principal cause. The advice is simple. Eat 3 meals a day and try to keep to a fairly regular schedule of meals. People associate noise with headaches, and for most of us, excessive noise creates the conditions for a headache. Very loud noise is unpleasant, and people usually remove themselves from it. Having said that, younger people tend to tolerate noise better than their elders, so I may be leaving noisy places far earlier than you. Just remember that exposure to too much noise may predispose you to a headache. Of course, we all associate headaches with studying. In fact, the headache probably doesn't come from the studying so much as from being tense. When we study hard, we often hunch over our work. Try raising your shoulders and tensing them, and now relax. Can you feel how much more comfortable a relaxed stance is? Another thing, it's very important to check that you are working in a good light. It will not actually hurt your eyes to work in a bad light, but it will make you tired very quickly, and is very likely to give you a headache. What's more, if you have the book flat on a desk in front of you, it'll be harder to read, and you'll have to hold your head at an odd angle. It is wise to have a book rest, which raises the material you are reading 45 degrees to the desk. This will help reduce your chance of a headache. Try to relax before bed, so that you will be relaxed when you try to sleep. A soak in a hot bath may be helpful. It's also important to really sleep when you go to bed. A good mattress is a wise investment for people who want to avoid headaches. This talk seems to keep coming back to tension. Tension may cause you to chew too forcefully, clench your jaw, or grind your teeth, and this in turn may lead to headaches. It is very easy to say that you shouldn't grind your teeth, and very hard to stop, particularly if you grind your teeth in your sleep. Try to avoid situations which will make you tense, particularly just before bed. If you do compulsively grind your teeth in your sleep, ask your dentist about a soft mouth guard. In general, try to eat regular meals and avoid tense situations. Be sure you get plenty of exercise. Hopefully your headaches will be greatly reduced. One other thing I should point out, avoid smoky rooms and cars. Such places certainly encourage headaches, and the smoke may be doing you quite serious long-term damage.
That is the end of part 4.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.